welcome to another edition of Born to Run, which is our podcast examining the lives of our gubernatorial candidates going into this June's primary. What we're looking at here is not so much politics, but pretty much how you got here from there. Our guest today is Sean Moody, Republican candidate for governor. Welcome, Sean.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you.
You too.
Now, I must confess, I know some of the answers to my questions here today because you and I have chatted in the past about your story, but it is a compelling one. And what we like to do here is go back to the very beginning. And you were born in Gorham, raised in Gorham.
Raised in Gorham, hometown, go back about five generations.
Five generations.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
So describe your the living situation, the home into which you were born in Gorham.
I think my parents, you know, separated when I was very young. I think I was only about a year old, year and a half. Mm-hmm. And my dad moved to Massachusetts and kind of started another life there. So he wasn't too far away, but he was out of the home. And as I started to remember my life evolving was we were living on Green Street with my grandparents. And they were wonderful people. They took great care of us. And my mom followed in the footsteps of her mom as a beautician.
Oh.
So she was became a self-employed beautician. And we just had a wonderful childhood. My older brother
Thad. How
many
kids?
My older brother Thad, my sister Kim and I, three of us.
Yep.
And we moved down on the South Street. Mom bought a home down there for about $6,000, I think it was. And we lived there for 4 or 5 years and then moved to Narragansett Street where my brother Thad still lives in the old homestead today.
Now that's where your shop is now, right?
Yes.
Narragansett Trail.
Up the street,
yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so your dad, was he part of the picture, not part of the picture?
He was, absolutely. I mean, he paid child support and, you know, we'd spend a week with him on vacation. He had a place in New Hampshire that we'd go to. So he was, he got remarried and mm-hmm. had a son. Half brother of ours, Chipper. So, he was involved, and his mom and dad lived in Gorham. My grandfather Jim, and my grandmother Ethlyn, mm-hmm. Nana and Grandpa Moody, and I got to be really close with my grandfather Jim during my formidable years, my late teen years when I started the shop. He'd come up and he was a taskmaster, keep me on track.
Yeah. And your mom was essentially a single mom.
Yes,
right? with three kids, not easy.
Not well, easy, and she, you know, she raised us, Bill, in an environment. I'd say to the people is there's a big difference between being raised in hard times and hurtful times. You know, we had hard times financially, but it was never hurtful. It was unconditional love. She was a mom's mom. I mean, I think that's where my brother and sister and I established the ability, the freedom. She believed in us, and she helped us to believe in ourselves.
Well, you quote her often.
Yeah.
She
was a remarkable lady. And she was actually Maine's apple queen.
Really?
Back in 1951 or 52, I believe. Yeah.
Is that right? Yep. Does Maine still have an apple queen?
I don't think so. Miss Maine, Mrs. Maine.
So you were what kind of kid? Were you a hellraiser? Were you a... I know you hung out at garages, so that kind of paints
ambitious.
A bit of a picture.
I mean, when I was a kid, I loved sports. I started all the sports. You know, we lived with the Philbricks on that same street, which they went on to become all-state athletes. And so we had a good neighborhood upbringing where we all played sports 24/7. But, you know, as you know, something, you know, kind of transitioned in my life was when Mom was hospitalized. I was about 13, and it just transitioned my life almost completely.
And what was she hospitalized for?
She had mental health issues, Bill. And I was alone at that point because my brother, older brother Thad, 6 years older, he was living with his buddies up at Watchuk Lake, up in Standish. And my sister Kim was over in Norway, the country Norway, as a foreign exchange student.
Oh.
So that was
you were on your own.
Difficult time. Well, I wasn't.
I mean, you had your extended family.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it was I was frightened. You know, I didn't really know what to do. I knew I didn't want to get taken away. And the other aspect of it was I was the only one in the home, and she's kind of falling apart. So I'm thinking, what am I going to be this awful person? You know, because Mom's you know, depressed and
You were blaming yourself.
Well, at that time,
it's easy to do when
you're a teenager.
Yeah,
it's
right.
I'm the only one here. And what else?
So you got exposed to mental health issues, very up close, very personal, very young.
Yeah, and not really understanding what was going on. So it's, again, through the eyes of of a teenager, early teenager. So when mom came home, she was hospitalized for a short time. Financially, we just were in tough shape. So we moved out of our house on Narragansett, and she bought a mobile home down in the patio trailer park. Mm-hmm. So then again, that was a big cultural shift, a shock to me, kind of taking me out of my neighborhood environment into kind of an over 50 environment. And I just knew instinctively, I just knew that, man, I got to make a move here. This isn't going to happen. Mm. So I got a job at a Corvette repair shop up the street on Narragansett, and I started working nights and weekends and saving my money. And I really fell in love with cars. I really found my passion.
You know, it's interesting because a kid that age, you're at a crossroads, even at that young age. You know, you can be angry, justifiably, at the world, and, you know, become that kind of problem child, as they might say.
That's right.
Or you can say, you know, this is, a new beginning, really, for you, right?
Yeah.
Which sounds like what you did. Why cars? What is it about cars?
Well, I think it was when we lived on Narragansett, I'd be out shooting baskets, yeah, and we'd be playing ball, and those muscle cars would be rumbling up Narragansett, and it just, you know, everything looks different at 13. The girls look different, you know, the guy, right? So I kind of, you know, it was a little intoxicating to me, you know, yeah, say, geez, I love the thrill of that engine and that sound and that horsepower.
So the vet goes by and everybody pauses.
Exactly.
And watches.
That's right. Yeah.
And dreams.
Yeah. And I mean, so when you think about my story, my life at that point, Bill, another influence that I had at that time was a fellow named Goodwin Hannaford, who was my cousin. And Goodwin was a shop teacher at Cape Elizabeth, but he also built racing engines and drag raced. He built racing engines for Homer Drew, who was like famous back then as a circle track guy. So I'd go up there on the weekends and help him clean parts and just kind of get my introduction into hot rods and high-performance vehicles. So I was working at Ron Caruso's shop, who was running on the national record as a drag racer, and helping Goodwin Hannaford, who was building engines for one of the, you know, he's an icon now, mm-hmm, one of the best circle track drivers, mm-hmm, in New England. So I get like incredible knowledge. I rebuilt my first engine. I was 15 years old.
Wow.
And I rumbled into high school at Gorham High with a 450 horse 69 Chevelle that I put together. So I was ahead of my years, not just from a maturity standpoint, but from a skill level,
yeah,
and talent.
And none of this was through the schools. I mean, this was all self.
It's all on the job training. Yeah, and these guys took such an interest in
it. And they took you in.
They took me everywhere. Yeah. Paid for everything. It was amazing. You know, take me to the drags. I drag raced, Bill. I was 13 years old, and I drag raced up to Oxford Plains Dragway.
Oh, my God.
So
and lived to tell the tale.
Well, yeah. I lost in that race, too. But it was, yeah. So, you know, they all say it was kind of the best of times, worst of times scenario where things at home. And I can remember laying in the bed, you know, at the mobile home, and my mom, I'd wake up, and I can hear her. She'd be crying.
Yeah.
And I'd go in and console her, and I'd put a wet washcloth on her forehead and talk to her. And
what was the illness? Was it like a
bipolar
type thing?
Yeah. I mean, back then it was called manic depression.
Manic depression,
which,
right,
you know, has evolved.
Which is a very unpredictable illness. I mean, you know, one minute you're up, one minute you're down.
Yeah, and there are patterns, there are trends. Yeah. And what I ended up doing, I'm going to jump ahead here now, yeah, but as her life evolved over time, I became her legal medical guardian in 1994. And with the support of, you know, my brother, my sister, you know, my wife, our whole family unit, it changed mom's life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a real advocate, and I really believe that the mental health system in Maine is in terrible shape. And I believe that I have the experience and the background, mm-hmm, to really be able to reshape that.
Well, that family component is huge. And I think that's where the system tends to break down a little bit right now. Is
that's right.
Families want to help, but they're kind of helpless.
Exactly right. Yeah. That's a great way to describe it, Bill. I asked the sheriff the other day, we're at a forum, and I said, how often do you run into a situation where somebody that's in crisis has a legal medical guardian? And he's like,
almost never.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a component right there that's just, and again, that's the stigma. Nobody wants to talk about it because it's, you know, it's.
Well, how did you feel back then as a teenager whose mother was struggling and you were struggling with her, trying to help. Yeah. Is this something that you kept under wraps? Did the other kids know about it?
I'm an internalizer. You know, I'm the type of person that, you know, if the world's falling apart, you're not going to know it through me. You know, I'm going to internalize it, and I'm going to, you know, deal with it, handle it, if you will. I established that at a very young age, and I turned to faith. You know, I'm a very faith-based person, and I
and did that. Did that come from your mom, too? Or is
yeah,
that,
she was. We went to the Methodist Church here in Gorham. She dragged us out of bed. You know? As you get to that point in your life, you're not necessarily
right. You're not feeling the spirit.
The church, spring out of bed. Yeah. But that was a very important component, because you need, as you know, Bill, you've been through a lot of things in your life and continue. And I think faith is a powerful component.
Yeah. So back to the garages, because that's really become your identity. You were going from one garage to the next and learning tools, you know, tools of the trade, all that. And at some point, obviously, struck out on your own.
That's right.
That happened pretty young, didn't it?
Yeah. I've always been a good saver. You know, I've always been able to save money. And so I socked some money away and bought a little quarter-acre piece of land off of Clint Allen and built a three-bay shop when I was 17. But
were you still in high school?
Yeah. But think about the context now. I started at 13, and I'm hanging around with people that are 7 or 8 years, 10 years older than me. And I'd always hung around with my older brother, Thad. I worshiped Thad, you know, and he took me everywhere. So I was like 13 going on 25, you know, in some ways.
Yeah.
So these older mentors, if you will, were fascinating to me. I soaked up everything they said. You know, if I had a chance to buy that lot downtown, I could have paid $1,000. It just sold for $10,000. So I listened to all these successful business people or townspeople, and just I was always a student.
How common was that back then? I mean, were you one of many, or were you the guy that everybody took under their wing?
No. Well, I think you got to be a good student for people. You know, it's like in your industry, in your business, you guys realize if you got someone that's willing to learn, you know, it's not a wise guy, you know, person that's grateful. You can tell they like you helping them, mentoring them. So I always tell our young people that in our shop today, you know, these guys will show you a lot, but you got to be a good student.
You got to listen.
You got to be a good student, a good listener.
So you opened this three-car garage. What was it called?
Back then it was Moody's Body Shop.
Moody's Body Shop.
Yeah.
And that's what you did, body work.
It was back in the woods. We didn't have any running water. We had no bathroom.
And did you have employees?
No, it was just me the last couple of years of school. My senior year, I actually worked in the co-op program. So I get out of school early at the cheap lunch and just go to work.
And this, I assume it was word of mouth.
Yes.
That's how you built your business. Yes. I mean, you probably weren't in a position to be running ads in the Press Herald or Evening Express back then.
Yeah, there was no. But I think it's important to note, too, Bill, at that point, I was 17, 18, that, I think sometimes I get pigeonholed in that, you know, the body shop guy. But the entrepreneurial spirit that I had, by the time I was 20, I had bought another shop down behind Shop and Save off a fella. Owner financed it, and I fixed up a little room in there. It was probably as big as this room right here, 10 by 15. Mm-hmm. No insulation. I was in there with a little kerosene heater. So I lived in one room for like 6 years of my life, three of which was in the garage downtown. But I was happy, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't want anyone to think, oh, poor guy. No, it was all in the effort to tighten up and put that money back into the business to help grow it. So by the time, and then shortly after that, I met my wife, Chrissy. We got married. We were running four businesses when I was 25 years old.
Tell me about that. Tell me about meeting your wife.
Oh God, she's been really the anchor in my life. I mean, she really is she was the right lady at the right time.
Had you known her for a long time or not?
She grew up in Gorham, and then she moved to South Portland about the high school years, and her parents had gotten divorced, and so we had a lot in common. Then she moved back to Gorham. And that's where I met her, back in town. So we've had four children. So, you know, again, you think of the activity level that we had going there in our 20s and 30s together. And she's remarkable. You know, she works right now. She's still on the Gorham Food Pantry board. She taught Sunday school. She really took great care of our children growing up, was always there. So
tell me how you met.
It takes a partner.
Blind date?
No, actually, she got in an accident.
Bump into her at the supermarket? She got an accident.
A Gorham High School teacher said, you got to go up and see this this guy, Sean Moody, he'll take care of you. Well, he got a son-in-law out of the, I don't know if he's anticipating that at the time. But they're a wonderful family. Yeah. She was born in Ellsworth, so she's a main gal, and got a great group of, you know, relatives up there. And we're fortunate. You know, I would describe myself, Bill, as an ordinary guy that's led an extraordinary life.
Yeah.
You know how I am. I'm a humble guy. We live in the same house for over 30 years. My pickup's got 150,000 miles on it.
Yet you have this very extensive business that you have just, it looks like you have grown, and growth has been kind of your standard operating procedures. Exactly. Just to always make it bigger and
better
and wider.
Yeah. You know? And you know what motivates me to grow has always been, I was never a money guy. Like, you know, some people want to make money and that's why they get in business, and that's America. And not to say that I didn't need to get ahead, I did. But I was always more motivated by taking care of people. You know, the customers came in and they kept coming in. So it's like, well, if we don't grow, we're not going to be able to service our customers. We need more coworkers. And then I really got to that phase in my life was like, you know, the coworkers are really the foundation of any organization is that culture.
Right.
You know, do they feel like they belong?
You have what? How many locations?
We have 11 locations.
11 locations.
Close to 200 coworker
owners. So have you ever worried, you know, you look at how far it's come from that 3-bay garage, you know, in Gorham. Have you ever worried about it getting too big and that impacting your ability to run the business? You're a very hands-on guy, and I know that you value your relationships with your employees. What do you don't even call them employees.
Co-workers. Because I feel like I work for them.
They don't
work for me.
So have you ever kind of hit the pause button and said, wait a minute, I don't want this thing to get out of control. I don't want it to get so big I can't run it the way I want.
I think we're very, very thoughtful in our decision making. We have a good group that makes decisions together. We have 50 people in our leadership component. So we grow very thoughtfully, and we make decisions, you know, with data and facts. So no, we have been able to grow at a rate that's been about 18% a year, which is pretty remarkable year over year. But it's been really a lot of it organic growth from growing our customer base. And then, you know what it is, Bill? It's your growing your people. You know, if your people grow, it helps the organization to grow. I think where people, you know, stumble or have problems, they run up ahead. You know, their ambition outpaces, you know, or their talent or abilities outpace the people that they work with.
And that creates a gulf between them and the people working for them.
Exactly. Yeah. Then they get the feeling of the weight of the world on their shoulders, when in fact, we have so much, you know, the way we run our organization is so sophisticated, it's hard for people to really even understand. I'll give you a little glimpse into it. We have open book management, which means that if you were hired tomorrow and you're at our quarterly profit sharing meeting, you're going to see our revenue, you know, our sales, our profit, our KPIs, our customer satisfaction rating. You're going to see all that information once a quarter right out in the open. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go through every location, goes through that process. And then we turn around and give 10% of our after-tax profits back to the coworkers in the form of profit sharing. So they actually get a check. You know, when the company's profitable, they benefit.
Well, there's an incentive right there.
Exactly.
Now, let's step away from the business for a second. I believe in 2010 when you ran for governor, that was your first time running for anything?
Yes. I was born to run.
Boy, yeah, I guess. Talk about going.
The title of the show.
Going for the brass ring. What led up to that? I mean, you know, it just seems kind of sudden for a businessman, an entrepreneur, a local guy who's lived in Gorham all his life, to suddenly go from that, which is very successful, to I'm running for governor. Were there steps that got you there?
It was like a lightning bolt moment, I guess if you call it that. The banking crisis, you remember when we had the financial collapse?
Yep.
See, I saw that. I have investments. We got real estate investments. You know, we got a whole portfolio of you know, equity that we've built over our 40-year career. So I'm very tuned in to, you know, what's going on the national, global level. And what happened was, Bill, is America got bit by the greed bug. You know, corporate America was so greedy. They were given no doc loans. They were loaning money to buy a home. One person wasn't even working.
Yep.
So we were on a track for, you know, running off the track. So what I recognized was that Wall Street, okay, and Washington had become one. Mm-hmm. So that experience to me, it's like, hey, we worked hard our whole life, pay our taxes, we're good, honest, hardworking Mainers. And it's like, whoa, you lift your head up and you see what's going on the national level. It's like the government and the corporate America are one.
Right.
And this is what did it for me. Then they turned around, devalued our dollar, our currency. So now all of a sudden, middle class America and small businesses are paying $4 a gallon for heating oil and $4 a gallon for gas. So not only did they bankrupt our financial system, they had the audacity to turn around and make us pay for it.
Yep.
And I was whoa, wait a minute, time out here.
So when you feel that way, I mean, what I'm getting at is some people run for town council, school board, that kind of thing.
I've always been
your sights higher.
A CEO, executive, that's just my nature. Right. I can problem solve. Well, most people could do a crossword puzzle or whatever. I can solve problems. It just systematically happened. My mind is 40 years of solving problems. And what I do is I solve the root cause of a problem.
Where does that come from? Are you just wired that way?
Yeah.
Did you have anybody back when you were a teacher or
good
anybody?
Mentors, starting right from 13 to 14 years old.
Just people.
I'm a student of human nature, a student of culture, organizations, how they operate, and how to move to create outcomes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm like a scientist when it comes to those things. So I'm able to look at root causes of problems, come up with collaborative solutions, and then here's the key. I'm able to execute. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of people fall down. You can have studies and strategies and all these things that sit on a shelf, collect dust, but the people that are actually able to execute on the strategy tactically, mm-hmm. so get a big picture thinker. As you said, Bill, it's also hands-on.
Yeah.
Understand the nuts and bolts and get to the people, the grassroots, to get the information so that you know if those changes are actually benefiting the organization the way they should.
Right.
And then matrix, manage it. So I'm a numbers, data guy, as well as really having a pulse on the compassion and the motivation of people.
It's a far cry from a 13-year-old kid or a 17-year-old kid opening a garage. I just want to close with this. You've lived in Gorm all your life.
Yep.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, five generations.
How has, and I'm looking at Gorm kind of as a microcosm here, because Gorm really is one of those towns that's undergone a lot of change. Compare the Gorm of today with the Gorm of your early school days. How much has it changed?
I mean, there were 13 dairy farms in Gorm when I grew up. I literally delivered newspapers when I was probably 8, 10 years old. I helped my brother, and then I took on the route about 10. We had two papers back then, mm-hmm. Evening Express,
yes,
you remember,
right.
And the Morning Edition. And when I got done in the morning, I'd go up to the Paddock Diner, and when Gorm Raceway was there, the harness racing track, and I'd walk over there, and I was sitting 10 years old. I'd walk over there, and I'd get on the Sulky with Buddy Reed, who happened to be ended up being in the Harness Racing Hall of Fame, and he would take me on the side of that Sulky out around that practice track. 10 years old,
And that's long gone.
Yeah, and I can remember riding my bicycle from the top of School Street, no hands, 6 o'clock after I finished the route in the morning, I'd go no hands, coast, down South Street, down, turn onto Main Street, and pull into Bob's Esso and get ginger ale for 10 mm-hmm. cents in the Coke machine that was outside and hit the ding ding, when you went over the rubber strips into the gas station. So yeah, Gorm went from really a blue collar,
Somewhat rural
community.
Town.
Absolutely. Yeah. 13
even
years
though it was right outside of Portland. I mean,
yeah,
it was.
Harness Racetrack was, we had a movie theater. We had a little ski slope, rope toe ski slope. We had a bowling alley. We had a maid. I mean, Gorm was like.
Do you miss it? Do you miss that Gorm?
I don't, because it's transitioned slowly over time. My wife and I, we bought a nice place. So we got like 14 acres of land, open space there, plenty of elbow room. My friends and family are still close by. So it happens over a period of time, but I reflect with some extremely fond and wonderful memories mm-hmm. about how Gorm was.
Yep.
But Gorm's still a great town today. We still have held on to the grassroots. The pressure we're feeling right now is most urban towns around the city is property tax increases with the school systems.
Right.
And that's going to be something we're going to need to come to grips with.
Well, I guess we're running out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that. But, Sean, I'm always fascinated by your story.
Thanks,
and,
Bill.
And we thank you for coming in today. And good luck going forward.
Yeah, well, you've got quite a story too, Bill. And there's a lot of good Mainers out there that have a lot in common. That's what makes Maine, Maine.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Well, again, Sean Moody, Republican candidate for governor. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm Bill Nemitz, and this has been another edition of Born to Run. You can find this and the other gubernatorial podcasts at pressherald.com.